least advanced have been CEOs of corporations. You're going to get the full spectrum in that sense. And so it's important to see spiritual creativity and service in that broader way of looking at it, seeing each of these institutions as evolving systems and people being inclined according to their inner nature to gravitate to one versus another that is consistent with their inner nature. So, now, let me kind of share with you how the inner process is viewed in terms of how is it that the soul tries to work with that personality, that lower self. You know, the lower self, the personality, is the sum total of form consciousness. It's the consciousness that where we have identified ourselves with our physical impulses, we've identified ourselves with our emotional experiences, and we've identified ourselves with our concrete mental thinking processes. And all of those things represent areas of awareness, but they're form-based. Mental plane, emotional plane, physical plane, perceptions. But there's this higher thing in each of us, this soul quality, this causal body, and it seeks to work with that personality. And so the first thing I want to share with you is this, that we're told in the ancient literature that the soul itself is in meditation throughout the entire duration of the outer life. Right now, your soul, which by the way, that's you, but your soul is in meditation right now. But it's so interesting because even the word meditation has to be defined in a different way, because we're given to understand that the soul meditates in three directions throughout the course of the life. Sometimes it's meditating outward, and the soul is found on the higher mental plane. Sometimes it's meditating outward, establishing rapport with the inner group that it's a part of. Sometimes it's meditating upward, and that's when it's trying to come into relationship with the greater life that it's a mere cell within. And sometimes it's meditating downward toward the personality for creative intention. And that's been called the downward gazing soul, the downward gazing soul. And it's in those moments when the soul is downward gazing that we have the beginnings of what can be understood as the creative insight process emerging. Downward gazing. Now, when the soul is downward gazing, it is believed that it really has to gather its energy to do it effectively, because it's got to assert its intention into a muddy place called the personality, filled with currents that are have measures of impurity. The personality, our lower natures, there are parts of us that are, you know, physically we are not as pure as we could be. From an emotional point of view, there are still going to be more base emotions that are still cropping up in our system. And we could also, rather than unitive emotions and uplifting emotions, we could have very base emotions. And we also have thoughts in our mental body that are separative rather than unitive. All of those are distorting factors. So we're given to understand that the soul has to assert itself with a lot of power to actually make penetration into the consciousness of that personality to give it the insight it wants to give, you see? Now, so that's something that maybe some of you have had this happen, where if the soul is meditating in three directions, have you ever had this happen to you where you have a really, really good meditation? Maybe you really, really feel like you're aligned, you're on the beam. Great morning meditation, and you begin your day that way, and it's good. But later on in the day, it seems to go away. It sort of vanishes. You had it and you lost it. And sometimes you can't determine why you lost it, even if you go back and think, now what happened today? Was there anything that sort of got in my way? And sometimes there's nothing. And the answer, the reason, there's many explanations for why that happens, but one of the explanations is the soul has turned its gaze. It was downward gazing early on when you were in meditation, and now it's, let us say, outward gazing. So One of the interesting things about this question of the soul's creative gaze is that the further we develop our consciousness and near enlightenment, the more the soul is able to learn itself how to gaze in three directions at the same time. And when the soul can downward gaze, outward gaze, upward gaze, all at the same time with equal faculty, they give you another name. They call you master. That's enlightenment. That's enlightenment. So I could define enlightenment in 100 ways, but that's one of the ways of understanding it, you see? So it's so interesting to think about the idea that the soul itself is actually something that's evolving. We tend to think that the soul is a perfect thing. It's not perfect. It's perfect only in one way. It's perfect in its potential. Its potentiality is to bring forth something that the world needs. But it's imperfect in its capacity to express itself through that personality without encumberment. And in many ways, we could define the whole evolution of consciousness as the gradual actualization of the soul's creative intention over time. You see? So the creative process is one that is understood as a bi-directional phenomena. That is to say, the soul is trying at times to make impression in the mind, first the mind nature or the emotional nature of the personality. And at the same time, there has to be a measure of purification in the lower self for right registration of that insight. But also, there has to be a kind of conviction by the personality to, you might say, upward gaze. And that's what when you meditate, when you sit down in the morning and meditate, that's the personality that's sitting down to meditate. That's the personality that's saying, I want to lift myself and my polarization and my sense of inner realization to a higher, subtler place. And so we sit down and we meditate in hopes of doing that. So in a way, that could be viewed as the upward-gazing personality. And when you have an upward-gazing personality occurring at the same time that you have a downward-gazing soul, that's it. Those are the moments of magical opportunity. And the sky's the limit of what you could do in those moments. You see? So much of this has a lot to do with this idea of getting into vertical synchronization between the two parts of yourself, the divinity within you and the lower nature, to make them as if they are in complete synthesis and cooperative rapport. And meditation is one of the main tools used on a personality level to facilitate that process. Is everybody with me? Are you following me okay? Okay. Now, so imagine that when the soul is going to speak its creative intention to the personality, it's going to do it through intuition. The soul speaks in faint intuitive whispers. And so we could say that the soul speaks in formless patterns. Intuition in a way is formless knowingness. It's kind of a funny thing about intuition, you know. The interesting thing about intuition is that the moment you have an intuition and say, this is my intuition, that's the moment that you're no longer having it. You get that? Because by the very fact that you've now said, this is it, what it is, you've made a form of it called a thought form. And so that's the amazing thing about intuition. When you express what it is, that's the moment you no longer are having it. and yet that's okay, because that's also understood as part of the physics of this process, the physics of it. The question is, can we not only receive it, an intuition, and build thought forms around it, but then can we bring those thought forms into the outer world as a function of service and creative expression? That's the question. It's all about realizing that we want to be able to still the mind in order to sense those faint whispers, and then we want to begin to build thought forms around that process or that insight. And then the real question is, can we then take those thought forms and elaborate on them, build texture to them, more detail to them, without distorting it? And that's a big challenge. You know, in the ancient rules of white magic given to us through theosophical literature and even maybe some of you are aware of the Alice Bailey material, it's a remarkable process of understanding that there are certain steps along the way where there are dangers, where there are points along the creative inner process where the lower self or the ego, let us say, can weasel in very, very, in a clever, hidden way, okay? So it's been said that magic is really the art of thought form building. And it's also about learning how to have those insights, build those thought forms, and yet remain an observer of it and not be captured by it. How to describe that? The whole process is to create thought forms, but not allow any part of yourself to identify with that thought form. Not a single part of us should say, this is my idea. Not a single part of us should say, I am that. Ideally, it's about learning how to separate three things in our consciousness to get this right. Realize that there's the thinker, that's you as a being. There's the process of thinking, and there's thoughts. Thinker engages mind, which creates motion, and through that motion, thoughts arise. But we tangle those things together, and we don't even realize it. Those three things tend to be woven together, and yet much of the evolutionary journey is to untangle it, to know the difference in your experience between the sense of beingness, which is the center of your existence. It's the ultimate place of isness in you, which we often call the monad. I don't know if you're familiar with that term, pure spirit. And then a sensitivity to how does the mind move, and a recognition that through those motions, something is assembled called a thought form. So a thought form becomes the product of those motions. So when you really get into the study of the magical process, it's also really a study of our own inner dynamics. What's happening? And can I distinguish between the thinker and the product of those thoughts, the product of that thinking process? Because the moment I lose that, there's a risk that a measure of distortion can be built into that thought form, you see? I don't know if you're familiar with the term ahamkara. Maybe some of you are. This is theosophy after all. Ahamkara, Blavatsky spoke of it. Ahamkara is a word that represents the tendency to relate your thoughts and your experiences back to yourself, even if it's very subtle, ahamkara. And the moment that ahamkara starts to weave itself into that inner creative process, the more we run the risk of a potential distortion, you see? And then we want to take those ideas. So let's say that we were able to hold ourselves as separate from our creation, we had a sense of that. Then the idea is to bring that that new thought form, that great idea, build more texture to it, build more detail to it. But then we got to bring it into the emotions, into the emotional field of the personality. And give it warmth, and give it magnetism, because that's the function of the use. The use of the emotional body in the magical process is to create two things. It's to take that thought form that you've now realized, it's to take it and give it what I would call a magnetic appeal. That is to say, you make it attractive, and also to give it a sense of vitality. You know, you're much more likely to manifest an idea if there's a certain measure of emotional conviction attached to the idea, you see, rather than just an idea that's cold and with no feeling. So there's a whole science of understanding how do you deliberately bring emotion into the system in the right way to create vitalization of an idea to help propel this process forward and at the same time make it magnetic. That's the challenge. And there's some dangers there too. We can get too close to it. And I want to get into that a little bit more in greater detail in a minute, but just to show you that this is a story, really, about taking something that is formless at the very beginning, the soul's intuitive prompting, bringing it into your mental body and giving it a form called a thought form, bringing that thought form into your emotional body and giving it a feeling nature, making it magnetic, making it vital, and then externalizing it into the outer world to create some sort of an effect that will have an uplifting result. And in each of those steps, there are certain skills that are suggested by the masters of old that we all should develop, and areas of caution, because each of those steps has a place or a feature to it where distortion can arise. Okay? So let's now go back, and I want to take you through a couple of those areas so that you get a feel for this. Let's look at the area of the beginning of a thought form. As I said earlier, it's important that we have a creative thought, but not own it, and keep us a measure of separateness from it. You know, a great master once said this, and it's one of those little phrases that I've always treasured for years, and I want to share it with you. He said this, he says, always realize that you are the director on the stool. Never leave the stool to become one of the characters on the stage. You are the director on the stool. Never leave the stool to become one of the characters on the stage. You are the beingness behind the phenomenon of consciousness. You are not that consciousness itself. You are the beingness that gives impulse to a new idea, but you're not that new idea. So there's that sense of remaining separate. One of the big things that's important to realize when we talk about the creative process from the plane of the mind is that when an idea is trying to crest on the shores of your consciousness through the impulses of the soul, it's more often going to be vague and nebulous at the beginning. Think about this just conceptually for a minute. What are we really doing when we talk about we're trying to bring something from a formless place and we want to bring it into greater degrees of density and externalize it as a dense form expression? So it's about a movement. It's all about a movement from formlessness to form, from internal existence to an external existence. And so there's a certain understanding that when we first get an inkling of a soul's intuition, it makes sense that it would likely be more tenuous, not very clear at first. A lot of times people will have a full-blown, you know, they'll meditate or they'll have some dream or something, and it'll be a full-blown picture of everything, all the detail. My recommendation when I hear that is be cautious and maybe dubious. I love what Kyle Gibran says in The Prophet, and maybe some of you know the book. He says, vague and nebulous is the beginning of all things, but not their end. And who knows, but a crystal is just mist and decay. And the idea here is that I think it's important to realize that sometimes the soul is trying to create the fundamental patterns in your consciousness to begin the creative process, and it may not appear as a full-blown idea. It may be the beginnings of it is often simply just the beginnings of a patterning of perception. See, the soul is something that, let's say the soul is hovering over the mental body of the personality. The soul begins often by trying to impress the patterning of perception of that mental body not creating a form itself, but a way of looking at things as a beginning to the process. Now later, through the maturation of that process, slowly more clarity of definition, specifics come out in it, texture in the thought form emerges. But at first, it's more often than not something that is rather vague and nebulous. And that's an important concept. You know, probably some of you have been in groups, and it makes me smile because I did this too, so I'm as guilty as anybody. But have you ever sat in a meditation group and everybody's in a circle and you're meditating, and when you get done, the first thing that's, when everybody's finished, the first thing that somebody says is, "What'd you get?" What'd you get? Well, yeah, the truth is, the highest meditations would seem to get nothing. That's the truth, because it's all about entering into the realm of the formless. So when I'm quickly saying, "What did I get?" It's suggesting that either I didn't get very deep, or the second possibility is that the imposter of the soul has woven itself into this. Now, that's a big subject, but there's a part of the lower self, a part of the personality that is called the imposter of the soul. It's like a sub-personality, the imposter of the soul. And each of us have an imposter to the soul. It's a part of the personality that falsely believes it is the soul. It's a wolf in sheep's attire. It's selfishness disguised as selflessness. And that imposter is also in this game of creativity. And so, for instance, when the person says, "What'd you get?" A lot of times it's the imposter within that is looking for something to lay claim to. Does this all make sense? Are you following me? I'm actually taking a variety of subjects and tying them all together for you. These are all big subjects. I could spend a whole day on the imposter of the soul. But I just want you to know that each one of us has an imposter that wants to get in the game. And a reason why I know all of us have it is because the imposter doesn't go away fully until the fourth initiation, and that's equivalent to being perfected, and that's a master. And so the very fact that you're here suggests you probably have the imposter still. Fair bet, okay? So our process is to try to bring something from formlessness down to form, but realize that there's a part of the lower self that wants to weave itself in and take subtle ownership of it. And so there's this sense of creating, but then looking at yourself and saying, You know, I always think that one of the best things we could do in every situation is in life, when something confronts you, ask yourself the question, which one of me is looking at this now? Which one of me? Because we are all dual. We all have a higher nature and a lower nature. And so the more we can start to recognize the nature of consciousness of the higher versus the nature of the lower, and then become discerning in the moment-to-moment aspects of life, that's an essential prerequisite to creating ultimate enlightenment down the road. We have to know the duality before we can transcend it, you see? So this is a story about creativity, but it's also a story about our evolution, the evolution of our own consciousness. Now, when that thought form is being brought into the emotional level, as I said, let's say that we've done a good job of creating, we've got an idea, something's come to us, we've let it mature over time. It started out vague and nebulous, but over time, I'm getting clarity, I'm getting a sense of what I need to do with this. And so now it's about bringing the emotion into it. And you're trying to, it's like taking a thought form and adding a watery sheath to it. A watery sheath. You see, in many ways, this whole process of creating something in the outer world is based upon the process of giving birth to something. And it's the physics of it are very similar to actually like a human being giving birth to a baby. I mean, when the soul incarnates, let's just look at it this way, when the soul incarnates, It first begins, it descends into the mental plane and begins to wrap itself in a layer of mental substance, which later on will become the mental body of the personality. It then descends further and it wraps itself in another layer of substance that becomes the emotional body of the personality, and then finally the dense physical. And so there's three layers that ultimately constitute the personality, which is why we often call the personality the threefold personality. But in a way, that's exactly what we're talking about when we talk about spiritual creativity, because the soul is bringing forth an intuition, and that intuition is like a new soul, and it's trying to first clothe itself in a mental sheath. That's the thought form. Then it needs to clothe itself in an emotional sheath. That's the feeling, the sentient aspect of the thought form. And then finally, it clothes itself in physical expression. It's out in the world, it's happening, it's taking form. So it's so interesting to think about this as just the same process of giving birth to a human being or incarnation. You're trying to incarnate a divine ideation, you see? Now, as that thought form is brought deliberately into the emotional body, did you catch that? I used the word deliberate. That's an important concept here, because it's so common, and I know this in my own experience, where you have a great idea, and yet on the heels of that great idea arises sort of an emotional enthusiasm around it. But if I were to follow what some of the masters have said about this process, is actually you don't want the emotions to take you. You want to choose the process of building in the emotional substance into it. It's really the story of, choosing deliberately when is the best time, what is the best circumstance when I should start to really build a feeling nature to this. And that's a tall order, because as I say, for most of us, certainly for myself, it's sort of I didn't say to myself, I got a good idea. When should I give it emotion? We don't usually think in those terms. And yet, from a deep inner perspective, that's exactly what has to happen. We want to use the instruments and not be used by the instruments. We, meaning we the soul, you the soul, want to utilize the mental, emotional, and physical sheath or outer garment, but not be used by that garment. And when the emotion captures us and takes us, it's now using us. We need that emotion. But we want to have such mastery that we choose when to give it that feeling. And we also have to choose how much feeling to give it. You know, because it's so interesting. There's this idea that there has to be the right amount of feeling built into this new idea. Because if you put too much feeling into an idea, well, you can make a mountain out of a molehill, right? You've all had that happen. Too much passion, and it exaggerates things, and therefore distorts things. But then, if you don't have enough emotion, what happens? It doesn't have enough oomph anymore. It's dry. It doesn't have enough power to push that vitality to move it forward. So it becomes it doesn't go anyplace. The old saying is that when there's too much water, the thought form drowns, not enough, and it dies of thirst. It's a really important thing to think about. What is the right degree of emotion that will facilitate what you want and at the same time not distort the idea? This is actually where some of the greatest challenges in the creative process occur. This is where many people get stuck here, because it's a very, very difficult phase in the creative process. You know, if I looked at it from an elements point of view, let's look at mind as being fire, the fire of mind. And so we've got a fiery new idea we want to bring into the world. And let's look at the emotions as being water. So what are we really saying here? We're saying, I want to bring fire into water. And when I put fire into water, what do you get? You get steam. And steam obscures vision. And many people make a wrong turn here because they don't realize that they have obscured vision because the emotions have been added and it's actually creating esteem and they don't know it. I like to look, imagine this. This is a visualization for you to kind of symbolically depict what I'm trying to say here. Imagine that you're in a field, out in a pasture. And imagine that it's just sunrise and you're out there and it's beautiful, but there's a ground fog. And now imagine that this ground fog, you can see the thickness of it and it's moving, it's undulating, okay? Now imagine that because it's moving, you're standing there and you see this opening in the fog and there's the brilliant gold orange sunrise right there. And it's like, there's the way to go, there's the light, there's the way to go. And you look over here and it's just gray, gray, gray. But then you look back at where you just were looking when you saw the, and now that's gone and it opens over here. By analogy, by metaphor, that's exactly the challenge that is faced at this phase of the creative process. And so many people are inclined to move to where they see the light initially, the sun initially, only to get a little ways down it and it covers it up and it's gone. And that's why so many things don't come to fruition, because it's one of the reasons, is because there's a catch here. The key is to be able to pause, to be able to let the fog settle. Let the fog settle. See, there's two things that work against us at this phase of the creative process. The first is that there's an added probability of obscured vision that's not realized. The second is that when you add emotion to the thought form, that creates a greater impulsivity to act. So we have both obscured vision and heightened impulsivity, which really can cause us to go the wrong way. You know, some of the masters say that there's one of the rules in white magic, rule 9, where it has to do with this idea that this is the place where a person can go down the left-hand path, falsely believing it is the right-hand path. And then you get down a ways, and then it takes a sharp turn to the left, but now it's too late, you see. So, you know, sometimes when I think about this, if it's easy to think, ooh, boy, that arrests my creative sense, you know. And this is not about arresting creativity at all. It's, remember, the destiny of the soul is to be that creative agent. But it means know the difference between a personality that's being created, creative, and the soul that's being creative, and realize that the soul has certain rules in its process, and it needs to use an instrument that's cooperative but is not distorting. Now but we take it further. I mean, let's take it to the next level where, okay, now we want to bring it into physical expression. We've got this great idea. Let's say we've built it well. And now let's say I'm going to give it that feeling, and now I feel, you know, I've got that conviction and that emotional magnetism about it, and I'm still able to hold myself detached, because this is also an area where we can easily over-identify with the feeling nature. So we still have to be the observer, okay? Okay, now I'm going to bring it into the world. There's some huge challenges in the magical process when it comes to this final step of externalizing something. One of them has to do with just right timing. That's right timing. And but what I feel is so interesting about the soul's right timing is that it has nothing to do with watches and calendars and lists and that sort of thing. Right timing from the soul's perspective has to do with two things. It has to do with timing in a larger context, that is to say, the soul works in larger units of time. The personality's in a hurry, but the soul, there's many things that may be coming into your mind and slowly being shaped now, where the actual externalization process may not be most suitable for another 20 years. But the beginnings of the construction of it are taking place now. And yet the personality says, 20 years, forget it, tomorrow, let's go for it, you know? You know, it's just like the personality, it wants enlightenment now, you know? As a great master once said, there is no hurry, and yet there's no time to lose. And so this idea of larger seasons, the cycles, there's astrological cycles that are crucial in the magical process. There are certain transits and progressions in your chart that show where there are unusual opportunities for bringing something forward, and also periods of time when there would be a greater challenge associated with it. So that's one area of timing, the sort of how do you fit, what is the timing of what you're trying to create and bring forward, how does it fit into the rhythmic nature of the larger living system that you're not only trying to serve, but you are a mere cell within. And that's one area of timing. The other area of timing is what we call etheric timing. Etheric timing. And that has to do with this idea of the etheric body itself. Now, I'm not sure how theosophy, is it called etheric here? The chakra system, that's referred to as the etheric. And it's the energy system underlying, and it's the nadis, and if you, your etheric body is also called your vital body. It's the sum total of the vitality underlying the fullness of your physical expression. And that etheric body ebbs and flows. If you watch it during the day, you know, you have your highs, your lows, you know, every day. It's good to measure that, to get a sense of what is my etheric rhythm. When does my system tend to vitalize? When does it tend to devitalize? And so part of the process of understanding right timing of delivery has to do with a monitoring of this etheric field in myself. When am I depleted? When am I charged? The other has to do with the same concept, but now looking at it environmentally. So for instance, in this room, there's an etheric field right now, in this room. And this room has, if we were to spend a whole day together, and all of you would be engaged in discussions and so forth, and relating to each other, and everything that goes on in a day's workshop, let us say, everything that happens is facilitating the building of an etheric sheath in the field. What is the magician must try to intuit what is the condition of the etheric field in any given moment. Because that's the nature of right timing in one sense, because as a teacher, I can give you an example of this. You know, there are times when you can feel, I can feel my own etheric body is depleted at certain times of the day, and sometimes it's vitalized, but you can also feel it in the field, in the ebb and flow of vitality within the room, within the environment. All of that is measurable. All of that needs to be measurable, because it's in that flow and the sensing of when it is high, when is it low, and when are the lesser cycles found within the greater cycles. So it's not just a big high and a low, but there are secondary cycles within the bigger cycles. All of that is, there's a kind of attuning to that that is useful and important, okay? And what's so interesting about that is that you might think that, it's obvious that, as a teacher, if I were to, let's say that we're in that phase of the day where oftentimes the after-lunch phenomena, you know about that? I'm glad I'm not there now, because that's always a tough period to work with, but you have to work with it. But, obviously that's not the time when you want to deliver your best. Fair enough, right? Because it's just going to fall on deaf ears in a certain sense, comparatively. But it's also true to say that when you're, let's say this, you're in a field and the group is very vital, it's like alive in the morning, mid-morning, just had your coffee or whatever, mid-morning, and so everybody's alive. Actually, that's not the best time to bring forth the best as well. Because both of them represent extremes. Both represent a high, one's a high point, one's a low point. We're given to understand that the magical moment is the midway point. The midway point in the etheric field, where you're in that transition between a high and low. And when, if the field reaches its midway point, and you yourself, you the magician, you the creator, happened personally to reach your own midway point, if those synchronize, that's it. That's the moment of magical opportunity, unparalleled. That's when you plant the seed. That's when you deliver. That's when you deliver the one thing that is the most important. You know, I've done talks to groups of people in different countries, and there have been cases, and this is not one of them, I'm going to share with it, but there have been cases when I've been asked to do a talk on some subject in the esoteric philosophy, and really it's a subject that there's only one thing I want to say, one sentence that I want to say, and yet I have to fill an hour. I'm going to work that field. I'm going to work with that field. I'm going to sense that field. And I might say, it may take 45 minutes for the field to get exactly where it needs to be, both in terms of preliminary foundational understanding, but also in terms of general vitality. It may take 45 minutes for that moment to arise. And so there's that sense of attentiveness to the field and its degree of vitality or lack of it. So think of it this way. As a magician, and as a teacher it's easy, but I mean this is true if you're an artist, this is true whatever kind of service you render. You know, I render through language, but some people through art, some people through labor and activity. There's many, many ways to understand service, but the point is that see the field that you're working with as if it were a womb, as if it were a womb. And just like a woman who wants to become pregnant, in her monthly cycle, she has a very, very narrow window of opportunity where this can happen. By analogy, it's the same thing. The field is like a big womb. And your job as a magician is to impregnate that womb with whatever it is you're trying to bring forward, to germinate, in hopes that it will germinate. Because if the timing is wrong, if the etheric timing is wrong, well, the masters would say this. They say that when this isn't properly considered, oftentimes the seed that is planted becomes a stillborn child. It dies at the moment of its birth. And you've had that happen, haven't you? You know? You had a great idea, but it just didn't go anywhere, or it just fell on deaf ears. So that's a big part of a big consideration in this final phase of bringing it forward. Another consideration, and I'll be very brief here because I realize I'm running out of time, but another consideration is something called the ancient fires. When you're trying to bring something into the world from a soul perspective, creatively, remember, the soul wants to make an uplifting contribution to something that transcends yourself, beyond yourself. And yet, think about the bigger picture for a moment. What is going on in humanity? Well, in this philosophy, it's understood that humanity is one entity, and that you and I are cells of consciousness within its nature. And that we as a species evolve over time through our relationship to ideation. We have new insights that come to us. We build those ideas. We create things from those new insights. And all of that's good, and it contributes to our cultural and social evolution. But as I often tell my students, that which is your temple today will become your prison tomorrow. as long as ideas give us growth and they feed us and expand our awareness of things, great. But the day will come where an idea or a set of ideas has outlived its relevance and becomes an obstacle, a prison rather than a temple. That's true of everything. That's true of it's true of all of us. And we get trapped in the old prison of ideas, old ideas. You know, it has been said that what is evil? Well, there's many definitions, but one definition of evil is the good that has outlived its usefulness. Evil is the good that has outlived its usefulness. It's the thought forms that at one time may have been very cutting edge and progressive and helpful to you, but no longer are, and yet the lower self has habitualized its relationship with those old ideas. So resistance. Now think of it from a larger perspective, all of humanity is one entity, the collective consciousness of humanity. It has progressive thinking going on, but there's a strong element of old archaic thinking. And that is important because those old ideas in the ancient literature, they're called the ancient fires. The power inherent in old ideas. And those old ideas are strong and lethal. And I've seen many a spiritual person who had a great idea and brought it into a field and was not prepared for the ancient fires, and the ancient fires attacked. And I mean, it was like they were incinerated by those fires, crawling out never to walk again. Of course, I'm being symbolic here, but the point is that the status quo is going to fight. And in a way, it's so interesting because it has been said that, you know, if you're really aligned with your soul, really working with the greater life, that doors should open for you, synchronicities should happen, right people cross your path at the right time, and all of that's true. All of that's true. But it's also true to say that the day will come when you will have to confront the enemy. And there's two enemies, actually. There's the enemy of your own lower nature that you're constantly trying to transform, but there's also the enemy out there called the ancient fires. What is the enemy? It's never people, ever. It's never people. It's old archaic ideas. And you see, in this understanding of things, thought forms are not just things held in the brain. Thought forms exist on the mental plane and are entities in their own right. They're beings. An idea is an entity, and it has a soul, and it has a personality. And I just shared with you a little earlier of how to understand that. You're trying to give an intuition, an intuitive truth, that's its soul, but the form becomes its personality as you manifest it. And eventually that form becomes so rigid over time that it squeezes out or you no longer can see the soul at its core, you see? So there's this idea that each of us in your creative work are going to run into the oppositional force, the ancient fires, and if we're not prepared for that, it can pretty much not only stop you, but sometimes stop you for the rest of your life in terms of feeling the courage to go out and do something. And these ancient fires are things that, there's a lot that could be said about how to deal with them, but the most fundamental thing to realize is this, that you can never deal with the ancient fires unless you remember one thing. And that is that those old ideas that are really powerful, at one time they were new ideas. At one time they were cutting edge perspectives. The key is to realize that we want to try to intuit what I call the sacred principles held within those old ideas. The sacred principles. The Tibetan master Dzogchen Khul, who was the inspiration for a lot of Alice Bailey's work, provided what are called the 15 councils, and one of the councils reads this way. I'm going to paraphrase it, but I'm pretty close on the wording. Find the golden thread of truth within illusion. Find the golden thread of truth within illusion. In other words, that old idea, as archaic and resistant as it is, there's still going to be some eternal principle at its core, but the form itself is a gross distortion of it now. And the way you deal with these ancient fires is to try to intuit what is the truth of the essence of truth embedded within that incredibly distorted old pattern. And then through your language, through your influence, through the way you interface with this person or these people or this situation, find a way of helping them recognize the essence of truth at the core and lift it with honor. Lift it with honor and hold that high and try to see if you can continue to hold it while you begin to reshape another language around how to give it a different form. And so it's holding the essence, which is eternal, past, present, and future, but reshaping the form so that it's more suitable to the present and the future. But if you drop this hand, you're done. So what I'm trying to say to you is the way we have to deal with the ancient fires is to recognize their duality, to recognize the soul nature of that old idea, which is an eternal thing, and to recognize the distorted expression of it as a thought or as an action. That's a distortion. That's its personality. It's rigid personality. And your ability and my ability to sense that and start working with it to help transform it can only occur if we can sense the same thing in ourselves. If I can sense my sacred nature, which is my soul nature, and I can clearly see it as something embedded in a lower self that has impurities and distortions, to the extent that I can see my own duality, I'm more able to see the duality in the other and in those old thought forms that are getting in the way. So it's a direct reflection of our consciousness. And when I can do that, then I can start to transform that, because you're going to run into it if you haven't already. You're going to run into the ancient fires, and they can be lethal. There's so much I could say about this, but it's just part of the magical process. It has to be considered. So as you can see, this is a deep subject, and I think I'm going to stop here and offer an opportunity if you'd like to ask some questions. I can make myself available for that.
Thank you. For people who do have questions, just raise your hand and I'll bring the microphone to you so that we can actually record the question as well as the answer. And we are taking questions from people online as well. Who'd like to go first? Very good.
Let's see how I can phrase this. Is the soul involved all the way from the fire to the form, or does the personality take over at some point and have to push that forward? Or is the soul involved all the way through the process?
Okay, that's a great question. And the soul being involved in the whole process is the goal, but rarely is the goal truly lived, okay? What often happens is the personality can be strong in its own right and sort of takes over, and the soul loses the grip of the process. But ideally, it's all about the soul working through the personality, and that personality recognizing itself as a mere servant to that greater thing, all the way down to the bottom, all the way down. In this philosophy, there's something called soul personality fusion, where the soul is, once we recognize our duality, then we want to infuse the soul into the personality so that the personality slowly lets go of the reins. Now, there's a whole thing, and this philosophy has this whole subject of initiation. Initiation is really all about understanding how much infusion has occurred. The more soul personality fusion that has occurred, the more capable the soul is of making that full extension of its creative intention to the bottom. No soul personality fusion, it can't be done. A little bit can be done. you see? And so there's a whole facet of this philosophy that talks about how much fusion is there and what does that suggest in terms of creative capacity? What does it suggest also about responsibility to make a service contribution? It's all based upon the proportional measurement of soul infusion through that personality. Yeah.
I really don't have a question, but for those of us who were here, if you heard that whistling earlier, that was an owl.
Oh.
And I just think it's rather synchronistic that an owl was flying around during this talk.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank
question.
You.
Are all truths subject to distortion?
Yeah. Measures of distortion, yeah. That's why, well, to quote Gibran again, Gibran, he said, say not I have found the truth, say rather I have found a truth. I often like to put it this way, and let's talk about it just for a moment from what is religious truth, spiritual truth, or religious truth. I firmly stand on this principle that no religion has found the truth, but every religion has found a piece of it. No religion has found the truth, but every religion has found a piece of it. But many of them believe they found the whole thing. And that's causing so many problems. But what part of a religion believes it's found the whole thing? Its personality. Because religion is an entity too. Every world religion is a being. And it has a higher nature, and it has a lower nature. And some of the greatest problems we have in religion, in that department of human life, is that its personality has incredible sway, and it's sometimes hard to see its mystical, soulful nature.
If the soul speaks to us in a whisper, how do we know we're listening to the soul or listening to another part of ourself that might not be as much wisdom?
That might what?
Might not have as much wisdom.
Yeah, that's a. First, let's never forget that in the truest sense, you are the soul. So having said that. So one of the big measures of which part of me is speaking here is to what extent is it decentralized? To what extent am I perceiving something that has little to do with me personally or my own benefit, but truly represents an insight into the betterment of the human condition in some way? But it's not going to be based upon size of effect. You know, a measure that is really useful is always remember this. The soul always evaluates itself with qualitative measures. The personality always evaluates itself with quantitative measures. The personality is always saying how much, how many, how often. The soul is saying how well. And so that's another thing that is sort of encouraged in this philosophy is to not only be attentive to the parts of you that give impulse to perceptions, but also be alert to how much of it is quantitative versus qualitative. And when I say quality, by the way, and just to complete this, I mean that like the seven rays are sometimes called the rays of quality. It's love, knowledge, beauty, harmony, wisdom, all of those are qualitative measures. They're not quantitative measures. Yeah.
I think you've mentioned several already, but do you have any other suggestions of how to aid the soul's infusion into and through the personality? And also, is that something that you'd have to worry then that the false self would take advantage of the opening?
Well, good question. Yeah, well, I mean, obviously, I mentioned a few things, and meditation, of course, is so important. I think it's one of those things where the more we can be alert to the subtleties of how our mind persuades us in one way or the other, and to notice how that moves, the better off we are. The more introspective we are and alert to how we fool ourselves, the better off we are. The imposter is tricky, though, because one of the things you'll, and maybe some of you read my book, because I have a whole section on this that talks about the imposter, and I try to lay out about a dozen discernments that would be helpful to know, because it gets tricky. You see, the further you are on the path, the more surreptitious the imposter is. That's the amazing thing about it. The more hidden it is, and the less, the more well disguised it is. And there's a whole reason behind all of that. But the key is to realize that that there are certain differences that are worth noting. I'll give you another example, and I kind of alluded to it earlier, but let me make it fuller for you. The relationship you have with time. The personality tends to want things now, and it wants to see results now. It wants to see the fruits of its labor now, or soon. And yet, there are many, many things that your soul and my soul are developing now that won't bear fruit until the next incarnation. Now, when the personality hears that, it goes, "Ugh, I don't like that. That doesn't sound good to me." But it is the truth of it. Now, there are some things that your soul will manifest in this life, and of course, the good news is that many of the things that were really developed in the last incarnation are now showing themselves in this incarnation. So you have to think in the whole picture. But ask yourself, what's your relationship to time? How do you look at time? So often we, instead of thinking about what's going to happen tomorrow or next week, how about asking the questions, where should I be in this work in 10 years? You know, think in those larger terms. I think of Stephen Covey, the man who, with the Seven Habits, the Seven Habits. He does a magnificent thing on time management, but it's amazing because when you really read it, he's really talking about an understanding of the dynamics between soul and personality and how they relate to time differently. And he says, and I totally agree with it, is we've got to start thinking in terms of longer views, a longer perspective. Look, real briefly, your soul has a different relationship to time because the personality, the lower self, its only connection to time is its litmus test is a single incarnation. It only exists for a single incarnation. So the personality is going to be in a hurry because that's all it knows. The soul has a multi-incarnational perspective. The soul, and I don't know what that is, how many, but I often think it's probably about 7 that it's attentive to, 3 before the current incarnation, 3 after. Those 7 incarnations together, from the soul's perspective, boom, that's one unit of evolutionary intention. Next 7 incarnations, boom, that's another unit of evolutionary intention. So just the very fact that in itself, you can see, I hope, is inclining us to realize that it probably would be helpful if we think in longer units of time. Instead of 5 minutes or 5 days, think of 5 or 10 years. What do you want to bring forward to make a difference in the world in 10 years, within 10 years? It's an exercise in the right direction anyway.
How would the consciousness of happiness, joy, bliss, Joseph Campbell talks about following your bliss. Mm-hmm. How does this fit in with what you've been saying?
Well, Joseph Campbell was a fantastic mythologist, and funny you should say that, I just re-listened to all of the audio tapes of his, I hadn't heard them for years, but on the power of myth. That notion of follow your bliss has a lot of merit, but I would, from an esoteric perspective, I would phrase that slightly differently. Here's how I would phrase it. Follow the trend of your thought life that gives rise to bliss. What is a great master once said, if you want to know what your soul's purpose is, look to the trend of your thinking. look to your trend of your thinking, but I'm talking about in those more lofty moments, your high moments, when you're thinking about life, the world, what it needs, and what your mind always wants to go back to over and over and over again, because in the middle of all of that, there's a golden thread, and that's it. And if you can grab that golden thread, the experience is bliss, you see? So I would just say that Campbell's idea is fantastic, and I'm just saying, but let's add the notion of the trend of thinking and its relationship to what evokes bliss, because that's the clue. You know, we're told that the soul, the causal body, is found on the higher mental plane, deep within. So it, with that understanding, it kind of makes sense that it may launch trends of lofty thought. So one of the ways to get a handle on your own nature and soul nature is, what do you like to think about? And I don't mean in your day-to-day life, but I mean in the larger patterns of passion and interest and potential bliss, you know. So, and just to highlight it further, the personality is preoccupied with happiness. The soul is the agent of joy. The monad is really the agent of bliss. So bliss is much higher than joy, even. Yeah, I see some big people back here. Oh, okay.
You had mentioned the seven rays. Mm-hmm. Is each of those rays associated with a particular master?
Yes, Chohan, yes. Yeah, we know all but one of them. Yeah.
Is that in your book?
The master's names?
And the associations?
I don't think so. I'd look at, we had a,
workshop.
Oh, it's been my workshops. But I don't know if I put, I do a whole section on each of the rays, but I don't remember putting the master's names in there. If you want them, I can give them to you, but yeah, no.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I'm still quite interested in holding essence of an idea or contribution of service, whatnot, high.
Yeah.
And working to change the form.
Yeah.
Perhaps the location, perhaps something about the associations of the form. Can you talk a little more about that?
Well, okay, I think the best way to talk about it is just to give you an example in history that will give you a sense of what we're talking about. Let's use somebody, I think of somebody like Osama bin Laden as a perhaps an example we can use, where, or sometimes we use Adolf Hitler as always a great target. We can use Adolf Hitler too. But in the case of Osama bin Laden, and jihadism, this is listed the bigger picture of this sort of militant jihadism. That's a thought form, or that's a series of thought forms that is very, very destructive to the outer world, obviously. So step number one is to look at that thought form and realize that it's ultra-conservative, but at one time it was actually cutting-edge philosophic spiritual thinking. But it's now ancient fire. Because what is it? It's an idea that was really, really, really cutting-edge thinking 1,000 years ago. 1,000 years ago. But you see how long thought forms hold, and they are reinforced and reinforced and solidified and become a prison. Remember that which is your temple will become your prison. A religion is a great example of that. When it steps into its fundamentalist department, we've got a prison. We've got ancient fire. But let's look at an Osama bin Laden and some of the principles underlying. I mean, this is a man that had a strong devotion to God, whatever, no matter how, but his narrow view of God, but the energy of devotion to the greater life was central to his existence. The energy of devotion to the greater life. And that's a principle. Devotion to greater life is a sacred principle. It's as sacred as the principle of love. And yet, it's clothed in a thought form that outlived itself 1,000 years ago, you see? So one of the things that we need to do is to hold in honor the principle of devotion to greater life. And somehow, if you know, and I'm not a person who's ever dealt with jihadists, so I can't use it as an experience here, but I can say this, that the more you can communicate in such a way with the jihadist in a way that somehow shapes an understanding that you see their strong devotion to the greater life, that's essential. Step number one is to see the golden thread of truth within the illusion, you see? Because we can't get anywhere unless we can see it. A simpler example would be, look at politics in our country today. The Republican platform and the Democratic platform, those are just thought forms. And by the way, they're both distorted. And each has a set of sacred principles at their core. The Democratic Party has a huge emphasis on the sacred principle of concern for the welfare of the larger whole. The Republican Party has a huge sacred principle called the sacred principle of individual liberty, and actually, both occultly are equal as sacred principles. But one looks at the other, because we polarize ourselves and try to identify with one over the other, we tend to only see the distorted shell and have difficulty seeing the sacred principle. So here would be my challenge to you as a way of closing, I guess, is think of the political platform that you are in opposition to, or the social issue that you're in opposition to, or the person that you're in opposition to, and ask yourself, what is the golden thread in that party that I'm not putting enough respect and honor to? That's going to be a challenge, because it means you actually have to go look deeper, and that's not so easy. That's why in the Alice Bailey writings, the Tibetan says, you know, one of the ways to start that process is to never use the term pro this or anti that, because in itself, those are terms that are divisive. People on the path today, from the occult perspective, are supposed to be the bridges, bridging all dualities, bridging left and right, masculine and feminine, the bridges of all oppositional dualities. And you can't really bridge unless you can see both the truth and the distortion on each side. And then there's also a greater bridge, which is the bridge between form and spirit, or the past and the future. How do we bridge and bring the essence of the old ideas from the past and carry it into the future, but let go of the form that essence has been trapped within? That's the ancient fire. We want to liberate it and carry the principles. So the principle of back to Osama bin Laden, the principle of devotion to greater life is got to be carried into the future. It's just that the form is no longer adequate to the times. So just think about it in your own life, and what are you most oppositional to, and then ask yourself, what's the So what I'd like to do today is to share with you an overview of how the esoteric philosophy looks at the magical process. What I'd like to do is first sort of lay out a fundamental principle to set the stage for that. And that principle is this, that every human soul is destined to be a creative agent. Every human soul is destined to be a magician. In that sense. And the word magic here is not about hocus pocus. Magic really is really a story about how to manifest anything. And in a certain sense, when I say that the destiny of every human soul is to be a magician, it's in the fabric of the nature of the soul, which is what we call that the causal body, that the soul has a creative intention, a capacity. And it must, in a way, evolution is such that full enlightenment isn't even possible unless the fullness of your soul's creative nature finds effective expression in the outer world. And one of the measures of that effectiveness is in the actual service that you render, and is it of uplifting value? The soul in each of us is the part of us that wants to work through a personality, the lower self, and this is the instrument for it, mental, emotional, and physical instrument. And it wants to do that, but it wants to do it without the personality getting in the way. And that's the problem. And in the process, it wants to make an uplifting contribution to something that transcends itself, something that is not related to itself, something bigger than that. And so fundamentally, the soul is destined to make manifest its creative potential. Now, what that creative potential is will vary. It varies from a variety of perspectives. One of the most important is that in the esoteric philosophy, we're told that there are seven types of souls, seven unique types of human souls. Sometimes they're called the seven rays. And that each type will have a different way of thinking about life, how a different way of framing the perceptions of how they see the outer world, and a different goal of trying to approach a creative expression that makes that uplifting contribution. And people of different ray lines, you might say, these are people that will pursue different contexts in society in order to serve. So there's, you know, there are some soul types that are doing fantastic creative work within the Department of Education. Others in the department of business, others in the world of religion, or the arts, or science, or government. All of those are social institutions that are indeed themselves governed by great ray tendencies of consciousness. And people will tend to gravitate to those social institutions that have an energetic affinity with their own higher nature, and find that as the place to express themselves, which is why in this philosophy it's understood that all social systems are sacred. Also, sometimes we think that somehow spirituality is the prerogative of religion, and that's not so. That's one department, but there's the Department of Government, there's the Department of Education, the area of the arts. As I say, all of those represent categories of human consciousness, and all of them have a higher and lower nature. Every social institution in this philosophy, anyway, it's understood that every social institution, in a way, is an entity. It's a category of consciousness, and it has a higher potential, and it has a lower tendency. And it's absolutely no different than you and I. In the sense that it is a soul and it is a personality, so the same can be said of each one of us. And so I guess I'm just trying to lay out this idea that service comes in many forms, and creative expression, therefore, comes in many forms, and one of the most fundamental distinctions is the ray of the soul itself. What is its nature? So there are some people that are really, really living from as much of their soul as possible, that may be in the business world, for instance. Some of the most advanced spiritual people I've ever met have been CEOs of corporations, and also some of the leaders.